welcome to the Corin Barraclough Show. Coming up, I'll talk to a heartbroken father who's alienated from his son after his ex-wife kidnapped him. I'll talk about a high-flying media executive who pleaded guilty and has been sentenced for theft in Melbourne, proving yet again that women are not angelic beings. Can I first say something about the criticism that's flared up after Magda Szubanski taking part in Dan Andrews' government ad campaign in the fight against coronavirus? Magda played her character from Kath and Kim, the netball player. Criticism was quick and fierce. It swiftly fell into anti-vax commentary and for those who appear convinced that coronavirus is all a conspiracy. What's interesting to me is that then leading figures on the left hopped in to start shouting misogyny. Lisa Wilkinson, co-host of Channel 10's The Project, tweeted, "From Magda Szubanski to Sam Frost to Emma Alberici and just about every woman in between. These days it seems it doesn't matter your talent, your good intentions, your social conscience, your looks. If you're female and you put yourself out there, expect to be trolled. Hashtag stop the madness. Hypocrisy, thy name is Lisa Wilkinson. You can't sit on screen and bash all men with your extremist anti-men rhetoric and then play the gender card. Has it occurred to you that criticism of Magda may be because she chose to align with a government which is currently dissolving democracy before our very eyes? Has it occurred to you that women are sometimes criticised because people just don't like them? It's not because they're women. And newsflash, women are not exempt from criticism. Now, I know some people get sick of talking about celebrities. To you, let me just say this. It's good when people in the public eye deal with issues that regular people face. And yes, by that I mean family law. I know celebrities live charmed lives, and yes, they have charmed bank balances. But when a celebrity like Johnny Depp goes through a messy breakup and faces allegations of abuse, it throws a light on the issue as a whole. Similarly, when Brad Pitt split with Angelina and had custody issues. Now, over the last week, there have been some really interesting reports that have emerged from legal documents filed by Seal against ex-wife Heidi Klum. You'll remember, these two were married for nearly a decade. According to these legal documents, Seal is asking a court to deny Heidi's request to take their four children to Germany. "I believe Heidi has a hidden agenda to move the children to Germany," Seal writes in these documents, which were obtained by The Blast. Heidi filed an emergency custody request with the court to force Seal to allow her to take the kids to Germany for 3 months while she films Germany's Next Top Model. The documents also reveal that Seal struggles to get access to see his children despite court orders. Seal's papers assert, "Unfortunately, when I ask Heidi for more time to see the children, Heidi often makes it unnecessarily difficult by alleging that she and the children are busy on particular days, that the children are ill, or that they simply cannot see me." Does this all sound familiar? I've seriously lost count of the number of fathers who've contacted me saying similar things, saying that their ex and mother of their children is making access difficult, or saying that the children are too ill to see them. It's never ending. This is, I believe, where we end up when this damaging narrative around women and their children is pushed out relentlessly through mainstream media. Let's be really clear here. Children do not belong to their mothers. Children are not property. Children have rights of their very own, and they have a right to see their father. Importantly, children are not weapons. On the same day I was reading about Seal's fears his children being moved to Germany, I read this interesting piece about the long-term effects of parental alienation. Remember that left-wing, gynocentric media like to pretend that parental alienation doesn't exist. That is complete rot. As this article points out, and I'll quote from it here, "The results are devastating for the alienated child and can last a lifetime. Not only does that child miss out on a lifetime of having an enjoyable and fulfilling relationship with the parent they've been conditioned to reject, they also develop some serious pathological behaviours and attitudes that carry into their adult lives. I'm so passionate about this subject because I've lived it. Some of the issues that alienated children can suffer from include difficulties in forming and maintaining relationships, lack of ability to tolerate anger or hostility, depression, addiction, and on the list goes. This article speaks about an unhealthy entitlement to a sense of rage, which I find especially interesting. The piece says they've been rewarded for being hostile and angry towards one of their parents, and this rage stays there and can be triggered at any time. So interesting. Perhaps these irritating fembots who like to screech about toxic masculinity could engage their brains and actually consider the long-term damage being caused to fatherless children thanks to parental alienation. Children deserve fathers. And before any of my loudmouth critics try to shout me down and pretend that good fathers aren't denied access to their children, let me get straight on with my interview and introduce Scott O'Dell. I came across Scott's heartbreaking story of parental alienation in a PA Facebook group. Let's have a listen, and a warning, this is very emotional. So Scott O'Dell, thank you so much for joining me. You're going to tell me your absolutely heartbreaking story of parental alienation. Please, can you tell me what you've been through?
Well, almost 2 years ago, I had been living here for several years with a woman I had married who was originally from Colombia. She was living in France at the time. She was studying international law. She had spoke three languages. You know, I had met her on an airplane in an airport in New Jersey when I was attending a funeral near Christmas. She was traveling from France to New Jersey, to Miami, and then to visit her family. So we met in the airport. We started a friendship. And then, you know, we were talking through WhatsApp for a few months. Then she came back from France and visited me. We fell in love and decided to get married. And then several years into the marriage, we had a child, and a lot of her family hadn't seen the baby. And, you know, she had said she wanted to go on a vacation, you know, to take the baby. But at that time, she didn't really have proper paperwork. She had a visa, but, you know, we had to wait for her to get her full residency in the United States. So she had told me that she was going to apply for a temporary hardship permit so that she can see her family. Her brother had been assaulted in Colombia, which was true, and her grandmother, one of her grandmothers, had died. So she led me to believe, and we filled out a letter and sent it to the government, and she told me it was approved. So we went on a vacation for 2 weeks, and at the end of the trip, you know, she told me that she wanted to stay in Colombia and that I could come home and I could sell my home and, you know, and prepare to live in Colombia with her. And I said, well, I'm not leaving my child here without me. We need to talk about these kind of things. And, you know, she refused and said, I'm not getting on the airplane. And I just said, well, we're going to have to go to the United States Embassy right now because I'm not leaving my son in this country. So we went to the embassy, and the embassy, you know, the U.S. Embassy in Bogota, and the embassy was closed. And then I saw that they were taking my son away in the streets. So I, you know, was screaming and yelling, help me, please. I'm an American citizen. My son is being, you know, taken from me and abducted. And they said, well, we can't really help you right now because we, you know, we're closed on Sundays. You know, we're open tomorrow. And then the Colombian police came, and then I guess she told them that he wasn't American and that he, you know, had Colombian paperwork, not a U.S. passport. I didn't have the birth certificate. I didn't know what was happening. You know, I didn't have any way to prove that he was my child. So I was frantic. You know, I was screaming, and I couldn't, I don't know how to explain it to you. You know, it's like a movie, you know, but yes. They wound up taking us to a police station, and I didn't speak the language very well. So I really couldn't explain myself. And she had a lawyer friend come that she had known for a really long time, say that he was not American. So they couldn't do anything for me. So I got back I got back to the airplane, you know, that the flight was scheduled for 2 hours back to the US. And as soon as I came home, I called the FBI and then the State Department to explain what had happened. So then we started the process for the next several years of trying to get him to come back here.
And you found out at that point that all of this had been planned in advance. Is that right? So that you were told that you were just going on a vacation.
Yes.
But she had done a lot of plotting and scheming in the background?
Yes. As soon as I got home, then I started to do research. I talked to the State Department. They had said they were, asked me what decisions I wanted to make in terms of what kind of case I wanted to open. So I opened the Hague Convention case, which basically is, I think it's 90 countries, around 90 countries, are in this treaty. And it basically says that if a child is abducted from a partnering member of the treaty, that they have to go back to their country of habitual residence where the child was living. So I opened that case, but in that time of waiting, I went to the job that she had, and I thought she was going on vacation, and they told me that she had quit the job, and told me that it was closed for the 2 weeks that that we were gone. And of course I went to the lawyer that did our papers, to establish her residency. And they told me that it was Hispanic Unity, it was the people who did our paperwork, that she had gone in there about a month previous and canceled the entire process of becoming a resident in the United States, giving up her visa permanently, I guess so that, they could never ask her to come back, because if they say you have to go back to the U.S., she doesn't have a visa anymore. So I had found out that there were steps taken to plan this. So I assume that when I was in Colombia, for that vacation, that they thought that maybe they could talk to me and say, yeah, let's let your son stay here and you go back and take care of the things that you need to take care of and then come back here and be with me. And if I would have done that, then they would have washed their hands of it and said, well, he let me stay here. He let me, do this. And his plan was to let me live here and then come and visit me. And I think that they would have just decided to leave me at that point and say, well, you allowed him to stay there, so, you have no case. But of course, I went to the embassy and caused a big problem, and we started the case from there.
And look, I'm sure this is really hard to talk about. So I know we're kind of stuck between that, you wanting to tell your story and get the word out there, and sure, more dragging up painful memories. But tell me what it was like sitting on that plane coming home, and then what you came home to, because you had left as part of a family, sure, or a child.
Sure. And well, the first thing I did was I went to the airport bar, and it was closed, and I was crying, I was very sad. They were opening at 12 o'clock, and they said I had to wait to have a drink, and I was like, okay, well, I'll wait. So I had the drink, and then I waited a little bit, got on the plane. I was really upset. And of course, when I was on the plane, I asked the steward for another drink, and, I asked him, he asked me the story, and I told him, and then he just said, here's two, just take it, you don't have to pay. I'm really sorry that this happened, I just went home. And then when I got home, I realized by looking through the things and, seeing that her clothes was still here, all the toys, the furniture, that, I started to look for his passport, which he said that was here. And of course it wasn't, his U.S. passport. And of course all his documents were gone, his birth certificate and our marriage license, everything. So I had to go to the Bureau of Vital Statistics and get all that stuff again. But I mean, it's crushing. It's crushing because you realize what just happened. You lost your child. I was used to going to sleep with him every night. And I've said this before, I got used to hearing his heartbeat, next to me. I got used to feeling his breath. I got used to waking up to his smile. And then all of a sudden he wasn't there anymore, And, I didn't think it was going to be such a long road. These cases are supposed to be handled in 6 weeks, yeah. But I guess their justice system is incredibly slow. They kept delaying it. And then finally I had a trial date of May 19th, and then COVID-19 struck and it just poof, disappeared. So I have to wait. And since then I've been trying to, obviously they tried to talk to me in the beginning, the family, and everything was fine. I was getting letters saying, hey, you're our son, we love you, just understand, you'll always be his father, you can come visit for Christmas. And I would say, well, coming for Christmas doesn't solve what just happened. I'm not just going to agree with somebody taking away my parental rights and acting like I don't exist anymore. Now my family here has never seen my son again. They've never got to speak to him. I get to see he's alive, you know, on a video camera sometimes if she's feeling mentally well, I guess, you know. I mean, I don't really get to bond with him. I mean, they taught him another language. I don't get to, you know, he doesn't speak English anymore. And, you know, I got letters and so forth about how great I was, you know, but then once I opened the case, then the alienation started. Nobody in her family is allowed to speak with me, and I'm a monster. You know, after, of course, the charges came down, then it was, well, I did it, but he abused me. You know, I was physically abused, economically abused, gender abused. I was everything, every kind of abuse you could imagine with no proof, nothing. I mean, I never even had a letter or a text message using profanity. So I want to defend myself, you know, but I haven't really been able to talk to anybody. The State Department seems to be dragging on this, and they said a lot of parents are suffering all around the world because everything is at a standstill. They have to rely on what a foreign government is going to do.
Yes.
So
how much did you know before about parental alienation?
Not much. I mean, I just started researching it, you know, after trying to figure out why somebody would be doing this. You know, it didn't make any sense to me, you know. And of course, she fit a lot of the categories that and the signs that I had seen, you know, with people just thinking about themselves, you know, that they don't have any empathy for anybody that may have loved the child. I mean, they feel that they know what's best for the child, and only they know what's best. So I've always believed that both parents should have responsibilities and have a part in the child going to school and their diet and who their friends are, you know. But I have not been able to make any decisions like that. I'm not allowed to call her school. That's a school that they put him in. Everything has to go through her. And in the beginning, her parents were trying to let me see the, you know, my child when she wasn't around. But then she found out about that and said, no, that's only has to go through me. I have to be in the room. I have to hear what he says. And they're forbidden. Everybody is forbidden from letting me see the Emmanuel, you know, for forever, I guess, until a court can say that I'm still his father. You know, right now, I mean, it's been torture. I mean, I've had almost 2 years of every night nightmares because there's nothing I can do. You know, he's just gone, you know, and it's horrible to just see he's alive. I mean, he knows, he senses that she doesn't like me or doesn't want me, you know, as a part of her life. I don't know. But so if she wasn't around, he would probably, you know, enjoy talking to me, but he knows. So he knows that if he bonds with me, it's probably not good. So, you know, that's what I know about alienation.
Yeah. And tell me how hard all of this has been on your mental health. Like how have you even been coping with that?
Well, you have to do things that are very healthy. You know, it tortures your mental health. I mean, you never have a good day. I mean, you can't enjoy life. I mean, you can distract yourself by finding hobbies. I mean, obviously you can't drink or do drugs. You know, you have to, you know, try to exercise. You know, anything you do that's like that is going to make you very depressed. So, or it will make you not control your emotions very well. Everybody has ups and downs in life. You know, everybody has moments of depression or sadness when you don't achieve your dreams or your goals, you know. But I had thought when I married this person that, I had reached the mountain, you know. I thought, you know, I don't have to dream about these things anymore. I had the family. I had the child, you know. I had my home, you know. I had everything that I could ask for. And then it was just all gone in an instant. Everything I ever loved, you know. So there's never an easy day. I mean, it's, you have to work very, very hard to try to just survive mentally. You know, you have to go to work. You have to try to make money. And you know, everybody knows what happened that's around your life here. And they see you as the man that lost his family, that lost everything, that had a kidnapped child. I mean, it's a shocking story to everyone that knows you and loves you. And sometimes you lose them too, because they don't know what to say to you anymore. Yeah. You don't only lose your child, you lose your family on both sides, because you've got such a big problem, you know, and they don't know what to say. It's like your child just disappears in some ways it might be worse than death because you don't have any closure. You don't know how many days it's going to go on where you can't sleep, you know, where you have to wake up and not forget that it happened, but just try to develop strength so that you can just get through a day and make sure that you're continuing to eat well, that you're taking care of your house, that you're trying your best, you know, to move forward in life, you know, but you keep fighting too. And you struggle with giving up sometimes, you know, because you think, should I just give up? I mean, the money, everybody looks at you as an ATM machine. So everybody says they can help you in the beginning, but then you start realizing after months and, you know, all this time goes by, you're like, well, what are you doing? Like, you know, everybody wants money, but then they say, well, there's nothing we can do right now. We're waiting on another government. We're waiting on them to give you a date, you know? So it is very, very, very difficult. And I'm sure other parents that are going through the same thing around the world, because it happens all around the world now that you have travel so easily that, I sympathize with everyone, you know, I empathize with them because it is very, very painful to deal with the loss of a child every single moment of your life, you know.
And it would have given you, I would imagine, a completely new understanding or new kind of passion for the importance of fathers' rights and actual equality when it comes to access and the right to be in God's life, you know, as well as parental alienation, which, as you say, is a huge and growing problem all around the world.
Well, people think they can get away with it because they realize, I mean, when they, I'm sure most of the people who do these things research it and they know how long it takes. They know how expensive it is. And once they have the child in their grasp, then you're the one that has to constantly be on defense and have to fight for your right to see them. I've always believed, and I still do, that both of us should have equal time. And that's all I've been asking for, is just equal time. But yeah. I suppose she wanted, you know, knew my love for our child and thought that I would just support her in another country. And until there's money, you know, coming to her, you know, she's obviously going to use the child as a weapon and not allow me to see him because she's going to say, well, you're not sending him money. You're not supporting him. You're not doing this. Well, I can't because our government said the minute that you send money there, you know, that means you agree to the child being in that situation, that you agree to your child going to that school or daycare, you know, or living in whatever house that he's living in. So, I mean, they had taken a lot of money from me before they did this, almost $15,000. So I don't feel guilty about anything, you know, in terms of sending money. I'm not going to send money for my son to live in another country. I still pay his insurance. I don't know what it costs in Australia, but here it's probably $100 a week, you know, for the best health care that I can provide. And he's not even here. So, I mean, if something does happen, obviously I continue to pay that, even though some people think I'm being foolish because he's not here to use it. But I still do that. You know, it's hard because you want your child, you want to guide them, you know, on their journey in life. You know, you want to share the things that you've accomplished in life and teach them lessons for how to prepare for being an adult, you know, not to make the same mistakes that I've made in life, you know, and I can't, you can't do that. You have no say in anything, nothing. All I can do is try to learn another language and learn phrases to try to keep telling him, I love him, I love him, I love him, you know, that's it. You know, that's all I can do is just keep telling him that I love him, you know. And it may, you know, in the end, I may run out of money. I may never get to see him again. But my son's going to know that I fought for him until I couldn't fight anymore. You know, I mean, that's all any parent can do in my situation is just continue to fight, say that you love them, and hope that some judge, somebody will say, I think this person really does love his child. I mean, you can go on with your life. I can go on with mine. I'm not bitter that if you don't want to be with me anymore. I just want to share equal time with my son. I want to be able to pick him up, take him to Disney, share both countries, share both cultures, share raising him, be with who you want, marry somebody else, whatever you want to do, go ahead, you know, but I just want to share. And I just don't understand that part of the alienation because they seem to want 100% control over everything. There is no compromise. There's no compromise at all. So I don't know if you have any questions for me, any more questions, but
well, it's just so heartbreaking. My heart really, it hurts for you. I wanted to ask you just before we wrap up though,
sure.
What your next move is and what you can do to stay sane in the meantime.
Well, my next move right now, I was trying to contact child welfare, you know, in the town where the baby's being held, but they just recently told me that they really only handle cases of domestic violence. So it really does have to get in front of a familiar judge, you know, somebody that handles these kind of issues. So the next step is waiting for judges to go back to work, you know, and to handle the case. I mean, apparently there's 9 judges for every 100,000 people in Colombia. So the caseload is usually, you know, 2 years behind normally. So the next step is to have our trial. They'll decide whether he will come back to the United States, if she will be forced to come back, or if they're going to keep our child, you know. So, you know, if they decide to keep him, then you can appeal, which is, 5,000, 10,000 more. I mean, I don't know how many appeals they get before it goes in front of the Hague Court. But I suppose at some point, you know, that I'll have to decide if they keep him there, then I'll have to file a case in their local jurisdiction. And, you know, that could be years, you know, that they finally say, okay, you can have the right to your son. But the problem is, even if a judge tells her that, she's always going to fear that I'm going to take him back here. So she believes that the only way that I can see him is under supervised visitation by her and her only, so that she can keep me from taking him back. So I don't know if she's ever going to, even if they tell her what to do, if she's going to allow it, because obviously when people commit these crimes, you know, they think that you would be the type of person to do that too. You know, so that's my next step, you know, and I would just say, you know, to other parents and for myself, is just to try to eat well, try to watch your health. If you have medications to take, you know, you take them. And try to distract yourself in the best way possible, the healthiest ways possible. Try to, you know, do what you love, you know, write, express yourself. Obviously, the alienation group that I found, where I found you, that has helped me a lot, seeing other people's stories. And I realized I wasn't alone, you know. Yes. And I've tried to respond to certain people when, you know, they've made comments and all that, because I know what they're feeling. And I've seen both sides of the story. I'm sure it happens. Male, you know, to females and males, men and women, you know, I've seen both sides of it. So I would just say that, you know, be as healthy as you can, and just, you know, self-help books. If you need to go see a professional, you know, I'm sure that helps a lot of people, a psychologist or a psychiatrist, because there's no shame, you know, in when you're dealing with this kind of emotional pain every single day and this kind of loss. I mean, it's the best thing you can do for yourself and your child is to be as healthy mentally as possible. It's not easy. I mean, you definitely have really bad days sometimes, and you're alone most of the time. So you have to really focus on your health. I mean, yeah. I mean, I know I've repeated myself. It's not easy. It's not. I mean, but professional help if you need it, I would say to go do that. But try to invest in really great hobbies, you know, to try to just distract yourself. You're never really going to feel like you have a great day, you know, or a good day, or even really be able to say that I'm happy today. I'd be lying to you if I said that I've had a happy day in 2 years, because I have not. If I got to hug him again, you know, and hold him right in front of me, yes, that would be a happy day. And I'm hoping that they open the country, because there's an international travel ban. Maybe I can arrange for a visitation in the next few months, and the second that I can travel, I will, you know. And who knows, maybe I'll give up my life here and I will, you know, sell everything and go down there at some point if I have to. I mean, you have to do what you have to do for your child. I mean, what do I do, stay here and just go to work? Or do I give up everything and go to be with my child? Obviously, I'm going to make the decision to go and be with my child on any level that I can possibly be with him. You know, I want him to know, and it makes me sad to say this, but I want him to know that I fought with everything I had, you know, and that I never, ever abandoned him. You know, that's really the most important thing, is that he knows that his father loved him and that I didn't give up, you know. So that's really my goal, you know, is to keep going. You know, I'm not trying to take him away from her. I don't want that. I want her to come back here and live the life that, you know, she married an American. She intended on staying here and getting papers here. So I just want to share him, you know, I just want to share him equally. And that's it. You know, I'm not trying to rip him away from, I know she loves him. You know, I know she loves him. It's just, her love is not the only love that matters.
Absolutely. Well said. My heart goes out to you. Please keep in touch with me, Scott, and let me know how you're going.
I will. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you so much for
taking me. Take care, Corinne. Bye. All right. Have a great day.
That was Scott O'Dell. It makes me heartbroken and furious in equal measure to hear such stories of children growing up being denied access to their fathers. Remember all that research about the long-term impact on children? Remember all the consequences alienated children face? This is at the very heart of what winds me up so much about this ridiculous pretense that women are somehow saints. They're not. Women are human beings. One look at the news shows you that women are just as capable of doing wrong, lying, cheating, stealing, or committing violence as men. Look at this story here. A cocaine addict stole $300,000 from the media company she managed. What did she spend it on? Well, she reportedly used it to bankroll her and her girlfriend's lavish lifestyle. Fancy holidays, gambling, drugs, and Uber Eats, of course. This woman created 132 fake invoices that were paid to the company she owned. She's pleaded guilty to theft and was sentenced to a minimum of 16 months jail. She was head of digital and creative for Essential Media Communications, which had offices in Melbourne and Sydney, and had worked with several high-profile clients, including the now-defunct Luke Batty Foundation. And look at this from the States. A convicted rapist, torturer and killer who squeezed her victim's testicles with pliers spoke at the Democratic National Convention. She was introduced by Democrats as an impactful community leader. No, she is not an impactful community leader. She squeezed her victim's testicles with pliers before he was murdered. This was a 55-year-old woman who was convicted for the kidnap, rape, torture and murder of a 62-year-old real estate broker in 1986. She and her gang of prostitutes drugged him and took him to their apartment in Harlem and subjected him to a three-week torture session. It included starvation, beatings, burnings and various forms of sexual torture. This woman was paroled in 2012, having served 26 years in prison. She'd served her time, but let's not pretend this person is an impactful community leader. Why is society so incapable of holding women accountable? We've got to join the dots with all this crap. Women who commit crimes are equally as guilty as men who commit crimes. No special passes, no invites to the DNC, and certainly no certificates for being impactful community leaders, for heaven's sake. And finally, this New York Post article claims that women are, quote, posing topless on mountaintops for empowerment. Now, this movement actually started in 2015, and I had hoped that we were rid of it, but unfortunately, it's taken off again. Female hikers whip off their tops and have a friend take a photo of them from behind. Now, you want to climb a mountain? Whip your top off and have a friend take a photo so you can post it on social media? Go for it, as long as it's legal where you are. But let's not pretend this has anything to do with empowerment. This is attention seeking. This is about chasing social media likes, and no one is going to convince me this has anything in the slightest to do with empowerment. Save your rubbish about this being taking control of your life. You're fooling precisely none of us. Right, that's enough Barraclough now. See you next week.
The Corinne Barraclough Show is a production of The Good Source, hosted by Corinne Barraclough. To watch, listen to or read more new media without the social justice warrior narratives or politically correct fact filter, visit goodsource.news. That's good, SAUCE.news. Become a Good Source supporter for exclusive access to live and unedited interview recordings, including the conversations before and after the show.